Okay, I'll do it over again. It is my great pleasure to visit this historic university for the first time, and I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation. Today my talk will be based on my recent work in collaboration with Shota Komatsu, who is in the audience. And as we all know, in the past 15 years, ADS-CFT correspondence has been vigorously studied from diverse aspects in the diverse setups. And today I would like to focus on the most basic aspect in the most basic setup, namely the structure of CFT in the duality between the n is equal to 4 supply on this theory and the string theory in ADS 5 versus 5. And needless to say, the basic ingredients of CFT are the two-point functions and three-point functions. And if you know all of them, we can study the more interesting properties of four-point functions in higher symmetries. Now, in the context of this basic duality, the correlation functions look like this. On the Cyprian-Mills side, we deal with the single trace Gaussian-invariant composite operator. And on the string side, the corresponding vertex operator, which is inserted on the boundary of the ADS 5. And studies of this basic correlation functions have been studied vigorously and naturally evolved in the following manner. From those with BPS states, which is more or less kinematical, to those involving non-BPS states, which are dynamical and more interesting, and from two-point functions to three-point functions. And truly, a large number of people contributed to this fascinating development using integrability-based methods such as integrable spin chains, Peter-Angertz, method of spectral curves, and so on. And along this flow, most recently, the focus has been on the non-BPS three-point functions using integrability on both sides of the correspondence. On the Cyprian-Mills side, the technology to compute the overlaps of the beta eigenstates, which correspond to the Gaussian-invariant operators, has been vigorously being developed, and I think the next speaker will give us a story about that. On the string side, of course, the quantization of the string in the curved space-time is very difficult, so the semi-classical integrability, instead, has been exploited for so-called heavy states, that is, with very large quantum numbers. And the focus of today's talk will be on the genuine heavy three-point functions. Now, such a holographic three-point function in the subtle point approximation has the following structure. It consists of the part involving the action, and the other part is the vertex operators, and the vertex operators are inserted in the points on the boundary of ADS, and it contains a very large quantum number, QI, such that the log of the vertex operator is of the same order as the action, namely the square root of the two-root coupling. And this X star is the saddle point configuration which satisfies this equation of motion. And near each of these insertion points, the solution X star approaches asymptotes to the saddle point solution for the two-point functions, which we know. Now, in evaluating this kind of three-point function, we encounter very, very serious difficulties. One difficulty is that currently no systematic method to construct conformally invariant precise vertex operators of interest, even semi-classically, have been known in the curved space-time of interest. And secondly, even if we had such vertex operators, we do not know of good three-pronged, three-legged saddle point solutions with which to evaluate the action and evaluate the vertex functions, vertex operators. So these obstacles seem to be insurmountable, apparently. However, it is possible to overcome these difficulties by exploiting the classical integrability of the string in ADS cross sphere space-time. And the key to the success is that the global information is connected to the local information through underlying integrability and analyticity. And this was first demonstrated by the work of Janik and Bersinski, who studied the strings in ADS, three-point function strings in ADS2 cross SK, and they succeeded in computing the contribution of the ADS2 part of the string, which is essentially the evaluation of the action. The contribution of the vertex operators are, in this particular case, is rather trivial because ADS2, the boundary of ADS2 is ADS1, the string is structureless on that boundary. However, the contribution of the sphere part, which contains the action part and the vertex part, is quite difficult and remains to be computed. And at about the same time, we independently studied the three-point functions at the large spin limit of the so-called GKP spinning strings, Gapser-Klebedov-Porikov strings in ADS3, which will be called LSGKP, LS standing for large spin limit. And we also were able to evaluate the finite part of the action. But we couldn't figure out how to compute the contributions of the vertex operators either. More recently, we succeeded in developing a general method for evaluating the contribution of the vertex operators. And we applied that to GKP strings and found a complete finite result for the LSGKP three-point solution. And in the rest of the talk, I would like to explain the outline of our work in part one and part two. And part one deals with the computation of the finite part of the action, which is rather similar to the calculation of the area of the Wilson loop for the gluon scattering developed by Alde and Malvasena and others. And one exploits the method of Hallmeyer reduction, just as in the case of the gluon scattering. And then the action of our interest will first be expressed in terms of certain contour integrals by the use of a generalized Riemann bilinear identity. And then it turns out that the properties of this contour integrals are encoded in the eigenfunctions of the auxiliary linear problem. And we study that from two directions. One is from we study the monodular matrices and their eigenfunctions. And also we looked at it from the viewpoint of the WKB analysis of eigenfunctions. And putting them together, we will be able to compute the finite part of the action. Now the second part consists of the study of the contribution of the vertex operators. And instead of dealing with the vertex operators, which we don't know, we will make use of the state operator correspondence to map them to wave functions, especially in terms of action angle variables. But of course, the action angle variables for nonlinear systems are very difficult to construct. However, if we use the framework of the spectral curve and the finite gap solution, we will be able to do so by the so-called Skulienin's method. And after getting these constructing action angle variables, we can evaluate them by making use of a global symmetry transformation. And then we can get, in this way, the contributions, the wave functions, that is, the vertex operators. We can apply that to check our method for the computation of two-point functions, and finally, we apply that to the three-point functions and obtain a complete answer. So let's begin the part one, which is the computation of the finite part of the action. And exclusively, we will be dealing with the string in the Euclidean ADS3 subspace of ADS5, described in these embedding coordinates here. And of course, they are related to the usual Poincaré coordinates in the usual way, and the boundary radius 3 is at z is equal to 0, and the boundary is described by two coordinates, small x and x bar. It is convenient to assemble these embedding coordinates into a matrix which transforms very nicely under the global symmetry transformation, global symmetry group being SL2 cross SL2, and it transforms in a covariant way. And the action of our interest, of course, is the tension times the area, and you can derive the usual way, the nonlinear equation motion, and impose the uniform conditions. And we would like to treat them in the Paul-Meyer reduction scheme. And this scheme describes the system with the G invariant fields alpha p and p bar, which are made up of the embedding coordinates in the usual way. And then the equation motion and the Virasoro conditions are equivalent to the flatness of certain left and right connections, b left and b right. And then you get the Sinch-Gordon-like equation for alpha and the holomorphicity conditions for P and P bar. Because of the integrability possessed by the system, one can extend these connections to the flat lattice connections with a complex vector parameter, and they can be expressed in terms of the alpha and P bar in this way. The details are not important here. And then the original B left and B right connections can be identified at the special values of the spectral parameter. Now, these flatness conditions are equivalent to the compatibility of the set of linear equations called auxiliary linear problem, like this. And the two independent solutions for this psi contain essentially all the important information. For example, the two sets of independent solutions for the original left and right problems, namely psi left and psi r, they are identified at the special values of the spectral parameter. And then you can introduce the famous SL2 invariant product, which will become very important in the second part of my talk. These solutions can be normalized, and using these normalized solutions, you can reconstruct the embedding coordinates in a very, very simple way. Now, let's describe a little bit about the DKP string solution that we are interested in. The so-called, what we will call the reference GKP solution is of this form. It has two parameters, kappa and omega, omega being the angular frequency with which the string rotates in the x1, x2 plane with respect to the Minkowski time t. If we look at it from the with respect to the Euclidean time tau, it should be depicted like this. This reference solution looks like this. By that I mean that it starts from tau is equal to minus infinity from the horizon, boundary, and at tau is equal to plus infinity goes into the horizon. Clearly, this is not the relevant configuration for studying the two-point function, which should start from the boundary and ends at the boundary. Eventually, we'll be interested in a situation like this. But the important thing here is that we can obtain this solution from the reference solution by a global transformation. This fact is going to be very important later. Now, if you take the very large spin limit of the solution simplifies a little bit. The omega degenerates with kappa, and the solution carries the rotation charge delta and the spin, which can be expressed in terms of kappa, or better put, SL2 left charge and SL2 right charge in terms of kappa. Now, if you look at the solution from the Paul-Meyer reduction point of view, then this PZ and P bar Z have double poles like this. And if you substitute them, auxiliary linear problem can be solved very easily. And this is a kind of solution you get. And because of this presence of the log, you find that there is a monodule around Z is equal to 0. And P hat, this is the equestrian momentum, which is expressed solely in terms of the parameter kappa. And this characterizes the behavior of our solution around each singularity, around each leg. Now let's come to the question of how to compute the area, the action. The area can be split into organized into the finite part and the log divergent part. And furthermore, the finite part can be put in this way using the equation motion. And we will be interested in this, what we call the regularized area expressed in this way. We want to compute the area of this object, the surface, which we don't know. Now, just as in the case of the gluon scattering problem, this area, regularized area, can be expressed in terms of this kind of integral, where lambda is the square root of pz, and omega is a slightly complicated object, but what is important is that this is a closed one form. Okay. And the behavior pz near this insertion point, of course, should be like this. It's a double pole, as I said. In fact, for the case of the three-point functions, this pz function can be uniquely determined. Now, it is very convenient to define the function, which is the integral of the square root of p, and what we call the capital lambda. And since we know everything about pz, we know about the structure of this lambda. And the lambda has apparently three log branch cuts running from the singularities, at each singularities. This has double poles, so square root, a single pole, so when you integrate it, you get a log. And also, this pz turned out to have two zeros, and there is one square root cut connecting two zeros. So obviously, it is convenient to consider the double cover D of the world sheet on which lambda is single value. So once you go to that setting, then you can use the Stokes theorem and express this regularized area as a contour integral, very simple manipulation like this, where the contour is slightly complicated, and for the case of LSGKP three-point function, it looks like this on the first sheet, and this is on the second sheet. Furthermore, we can re-express this integral more explicitly by using the so-called generalization of the Riemann bilinear identity. And the usual Riemann bilinear identity for closed one-forms lambda omega is very familiar. For example, in the case of the hyper-elliptic Riemann surface with genus 1, that is the torus, okay, this integral can be written as a product of integrals over two cycles, A cycles and B cycles. And one can actually derive a generalization for the case with additional log branch cuts corresponding to these kinds of structure. And the full identity, I will not show you, is rather complicated, but for the LSGKP, large spin limit of the GKP strings, substantial simplification occurs, and if you manipulate it a little bit, you can get the most convenient form to be like this. This again consists of the product of two integrals. One integral is very simple. It is a square root of p integrated over these small circle around each singularities. The second integral is more interesting, which goes around a little bit complicated contour, dj, and the major task from now on will be how to evaluate this integral over omega. And as you can imagine from this picture, the information about this integral is contained in the behavior of the eigenfunctions of the auxiliary linear problem around these singularities and along the paths which connect these singularities. So, in order to study that, we look at the auxiliary linear problem. And as I said, globally, we do not know the saddle point solution. That is a big problem. But locally, around each ZI, we know the solution, which behaves like a LSGKP solution, which is characterized by the local monodery matrix, as we show before. And each MI separately can be diagonalized in this way, and you can easily find the eigenvectors, which I call I plus minus, distinguished by the sign up in the exponent. Now, although MIs cannot be diagonalized simultaneously, once you use the very simple properties like these, you can find MI and the eigenvectors I plus minus up to some unknown constants. You cannot determine them completely, but up to certain unknown constants. But fortunately, these constants cancel in some combinations of the SL2 invariant products of these eigenfunctions. For instance, this is an example. So the log of these products can be expressed in terms of p hat, which we know completely. Okay. But still we have a problem. What we would like to know later is individual inner products, not the sum of it. And in order to separate out the individual terms, we need to know the global analyticity properties of these SL2 invariant products as a function of the Z. So we have to look at the solution in terms of Z. So we try to solve the auxiliary linear problem powers of Z. We expand the wave function this way. And it's a tedious work, but you can solve for the S minus 1, S0, and these coefficients. And in the vicinity of each ZI, of course, we have two solutions. And in this case, we should classify the two independent solutions as small solution, which decreases exponentially, and therefore unambiguous, and the big solution, which is increasing exponentially, and ambiguous because it can contain a multiple of small solutions. So we will be interested in the small solutions, which are unambiguous. Now, we want to combine these two types of analysis together, and to do that, we have to relate these small solutions with the I plus minus type solutions. And this identification depends on the imaginary part of Z, because S minus 1 is actually imaginary. So you have to separate the analysis into regions. For the positive region, with certain configurations of kappa, you can identify S's and I plus minus in a particular way. And you can find a remarkable result that the contour integrals that we are looking for appear in the particular ratios of these inner products. So once we can compute these inner products, you can extract out this information. From that, we know the answer for the action, the area. So in the... Oh. So in the other region, the identification with I plus minus are reversed, and therefore, for instance, for S1 and S2 of this product, depending on the sign of the imaginary part of the spectral parameter, we can get these identifications. Once you have this relation, then you can apply the so-called Wiener-Hopf decomposition formula, which extracts out these parts of this kind of expression. So identify F with this, G with this, and the whole thing is known. So therefore, in this way, we can obtain each of these quantities separately in terms of p hat. So we are all done. The regularized area is expressed in terms of this integral, which is contained in the ratio of these. These are identified with this kind of products, which are made up of PIs, which are defined completely in terms of kappa. Therefore, we can compute the area in terms of kappa explicitly like this. This is the result. Okay, this is a function which is maybe familiar to those of you who work in this kind of area. And this expression is completely explicit in terms of kappa. So, I'm a little bit behind schedule. Let's go to the part two and discuss the contribution of the vertex operators. So, as I said in the introduction, in order to avoid the difficulty of constructing the vertex operators themselves, we will use the state operator correspondence to map the vertex operators to wave functions. And in the saddle point approximation, it goes like this, namely that we put a vertex operator at the origin, and then we evolve it with this kind of factor to this circle, and you can define a wave function on the circle. Here, the Q is some canonical variable, and Q star is the saddle point configuration. Now, if we can use as Q the action angle variables, then the wave functions are very easily constructed, like this. It's in any textbook. However, the problem is, of course, that it is extremely hard to construct action angle variables for nonlinear systems. Fortunately, for integrable systems like we have, we may use the so-called Skolnin's method to construct action angle variables. And I will explain that a little bit here. So to make use of the Skolnin's method, instead of the Pohlmeier reduction, it is more convenient to use the framework of spectral curve of finite gap solution. And the basic object of this formalism is the right flat current. By that I mean SL2R covariant, SL2 left invariant current, defined as usual in this way. And you can promote that to the right lattice connection with the spectra parameter X, which is related to the previous parameter in a particular way. And apparently these currents have singularities at X is equal to plus minus 1. And later we will need a left flat current as well. Now the most important object is the monodery matrix, defined as the path order exponential of these connections. And as we already said, when diagonalized, the quasi-momentum appears as the eigenvalues. Now, the properties of this monodery matrix is very conveniently encoded in the so-called spectral curve gamma, defined in this way. And in our particular case, since omega is a 2x2 matrix, it describes a hyper-elliptic Riemann surface with certain singularities. And we have to know the structure of the singularities. To do that, of course, you have to look at the behavior at x is equal to infinity and 0, and also at plus minus 1. And at infinity and 0, you find the appearance of the conserved right charge and the left global charge. And at x is equal to plus minus 1, leading singularity behavior of this p hat x, the quasi-momentum, is dictated by the Virasoro condition, like this. This is different from the usual case studied before, that is the string in R cross S3. In that case, this part is non-zero. But in our case, our string is entirely in S3, so therefore it is zero. This means that JZ is congruent to a special Jordan block. So you have to look at the next leading order in order to diagonalize this matrix. So the result is like this. So instead of the simple poles, you have a square root singularity. This is a little bit new. So in this way, you can figure out the structure of the spectral curve, which I draw for genus 1 case for simplicity. And these are the usual cuts. And this signifies this singular structure. Now, let's go to the Skolnin's method. For this method, the important object is the so-called normalized Baker-Akita eigenvector of the monodomy matrix evaluated at sigma is equal to 0. So this is the definition of H, and N is some normalization vector to be specified later. It is known that this vector has g plus one poles in the case of g genus as a function of x, spectral parameter x. And the positions on the spectral curve will be denoted by small gammas, this. And because this monodromy matrix is made up of string variables, they are dynamical variables, you can compute the Poisson brackets. And through this relation, the dividing relation, you find that these pole positions also become dynamical variables. And that's the point of Scudini. Scudini constructed canonical variables associated to these poles. And this was applied to the string case by Doria and Bisado, and you can apply that to our Pleasant case as well. So the canonical pairs Q's and P's are identified as Z's and P hat, where Z is the Zhukovsky variable, okay, and P hat is the usual quasi-momentum. Now, once you have P's and Q's, then you know how to construct action variables, integral over P dQ. In this particular case, the contour should be taken around the A cycles, and also around the cycle at infinity, actually. And this is what we usually recognize as the filling fraction. And these are conserved quantities. And what we want is the angle variable, so we have to find the conjugate to these. And to find that, you have to make a canonical transformation by finding a generating function which generates the canonical transformation. So this is the defining equations. And if you integrate this, you can find the generating function. And then you have to differentiate with respect to SI, and that turns out to be equivalent to adding to that integrand a one form, omega I, which has certain properties. Okay. So in the end, we obtain the action, we construct the action variable, angle variables, I'm sorry, as this kind of an integral, which can be recognized as an Abelmann. Okay. And you can check that indeed, these angle variables evolve linearly in time, as they should for classical solutions. And we actually need one more angle variable, which should be conjugate to left global charge S naught. We have been dealing with left invariant right current, so this information cannot be seen. Therefore, we have to go through the same analysis for the left connection to get this piece of information as well. Now, since I don't have time, I mean, it's very instructive to go through the explicit calculation for the LSGKP string, how the screening method works, but I'm sorry I don't have time, so I have to skip it. So now we have constructed the angle variables, but still we have to be able to evaluate these angle variables for general finite gap solution, which I call X. So how do we do that? The main idea is very simple. As we said before, we can produce the solution we want from a suitable reference solution by a global transformation. This is a very important thing. So once we make use of this, then you can actually compute the angle variable for the actual solution we want with respect relative to the angle variables for the reference solution. In other words, we would like to compute how the angle variable shifts from here to here. Okay. And in fact, we can obtain an explicit formula for that. So as we said, the angle variables are associated with the positions of the poles of the Baker-Akins-Ohr vector. So the question is, how do the poles move under the global translation? So that's the question. So under global right transformation, VR, the normalized Baker-Akins-Ohr vector gets transformed in this manner. It not only gets multiplied by a matrix of this transformation, but also you need a factor which is to keep this guy normalized. Okay. So under this transformation, the positions of the pole change from gamma I, which are the positions for this vector, to a new position, gamma I prime, for this guy. In other words, this factor must remove the poles, the old poles, and add the new poles. Put it differently, it means that the divisor of this function must be of this form. So this is conveniently encoded in the meromorphic differential, df over f, which contains the poles at gamma I prime and gamma I with residues plus 1 and minus 1. So though I don't go through it, by studying the structure of this particular differential, you can prove the following. The first, that mi, phi I, the angle variables associated to the genus G, usual cycles, do not change under the global transformation. What changes is only the one which is associated to the circle at infinity, that is the right global charge. And moreover, you can find the explicit form of the shift of this angle variables from the asymptotic behavior of the reference solution at x is equal to plus minus infinity. So this is the explicit formula. And you can do the similar analysis for the left current, and we get the similar formula for the change for the left charge. So this is the master formula, a very explicit formula, which depends on the components of the left, components of the right transformation, the components of the left transformation. But it still depends, of course, on the normalization vectors. So how do we fix the normalization vectors? They are fixed by the requirement that the wave functions were constructed this way, which carry definite delta and s, should correspond to conformal primary operators at x is equal to 0, and therefore it should be invariant under the special conformal transformation. Once you impose this condition, you can determine these normalization vector. And then you get an even simpler practical master formula. So with this formula, you can compute the shift of the angle variables explicitly. And this expression involves only the diagonal elements of the transformation matrices. And that is very natural because they correspond to the effective dilatations and rotations. Okay, I have 10 minutes. Let's see. Okay, let me go through this. Let me now sketch how we can compute the two-point functions using this idea. Okay. So this is the solution corresponding to the two-point function. And here is a vertex operator inserted here and another operator here. So the wave function, what we want to compute is a wave function here and wave function there. So the wave function psi 1 corresponding to the insertion of the vertex operator at the origin can be computed relative to this the wave function here in terms of the formula that I showed by the shift of the angle variables. So it's very straightforward. You just figure out the global transformation which makes this solution into this solution. Just compare. Now, as for this part, the insertion of the vertex operator here, then you cannot compare this with this solution directly. So you have to first translate it over to here. But still, the direction is different because in order to use the state operator correspondence, you have to use the local cylinder coordinate. So you must flip the sign of tau and sigma. So you get this kind of case. Now you can compare this with this in a similar way. And so if you do that, then you get a general formula like this, okay, which contains P and E. P's and E's are the worksheet momentum and the energy. Of course, they should be put to zero, but for the purpose of education, I leave it here. So it still depends on the location of the vertex operators. Once you impose the Virasoro conditions, they disappear as they should, and we get a solution like this. We get the contribution like this, and this is a divergent contribution. And this, however, cancelled is of the precise form which gets cancelled with the contribution from the action. So therefore, altogether, you get the finite result. And in the elliptic GKP string, you don't have to take the large scale limit. You can compute it for the elliptic original elliptic GKP string, and it has the nice correct answer. So I think I have 5 minutes. So let's come to the last topic, that is the computation of the three-point functions for the LSTKP solutions. And again, the theme is the interlacing of the local and global information. As I said repeatedly, we do not know the global solution, global saddle point solution. But we know the local eigensolutions, I plus minus left, I plus minus right, for the left and right auxiliary problems. So we can at least expand the unknown global solutions, psi left and psi r, near the in the vicinity of zi, in terms of these eigensolutions. So I don't know these coefficients yet. But once I know these guys, I can plug it into the reconstruction formula, and we can figure out the string solution, local string solutions, around each zi, which is described by these unknown coefficients, betas and alphas, okay, the zener products. Also, at the same time, we can express the location of the vertex operators on the boundary in terms of the same coefficients. Now, how do we compute the wave functions? So by now, it should be very simple. So I have this blue guy, and this is the solution. It's simplified, but of course it's fat. But to compare the to figure out the angle variables for this leg, I have to compare that with this reference solution here. So first step is to translate each leg to the origin. And then you can figure out what kind of global transformations transform this into the solution. Once I get these information, then you can use this practical master formula to compute the angle variables, and hence the wave functions. So you do that for the three legs, and you get the wave functions. But still, of course, these shifts of the angle variables are expressed in terms of the unknown coefficients. So what do we do? Fortunately, they can be expressed in a very extremely useful form. For instance, the beta 1 plus square can be expressed in this way. And this is the information about the relative positions that we're interested in. And the rest is expressed in terms of the overlaps of local solutions. And this is something familiar. We encountered it before. If we identify these solutions appropriately with small solutions, we are dealing with this kind of entity, which was computed in part one. So we know everything. So we're putting them together. This is the contribution of the wave functions. It has the correct x dependence, and the coefficient here is a little bit complicated. It is expressed very compactly, but probably not the best way to express it. But anyway, h minus h plus takes a function as an argument and gives you an expression in terms of kappa. So these are all in terms of kappa. And one thing I want to emphasize is that this contains the logarithmic divergence, just as we had for the two-point function. But this exactly cancels with the log divergence coming from the action part, which I didn't show you how to compute. But anyway, this exactly cancels it. So putting together with the action part, everything is completely finite. Oh, by the way, the finite part of the action we computed in part one can be expressed in terms of the same kind of notation. So putting together, we get the final result for the three-point function. And what I want to emphasize is that despite the lack of knowledge of the vertex operators and the saddle point solutions, one can obtain a completely explicit result. And this is a very strong demonstration that integrability is quite powerful beyond the spectral problem. And I think the next talk will illustrate that from the superior side as well. So this is the final answer. And this three-point coupling, the log of it, is expressed in terms of kappa completely, with certain functions appearing here. And unfortunately, at the present moment, corresponding result on the Supriyar-Mill side is not yet available. So we can't, of course, that would be a weak coupling result, in our words, it's a strong coupling result, but we don't have anything to compare it with. But at least we can make a consistency check. If you take the limit that one of the charges becomes exactly zero, that means that we are approaching two-point function rather than three-point function. And if we put the kappa 2 equal to kappa 1, then we should be able to get exactly the properly normalized two-point function. And we do. We do get that result. So therefore, although the result here looks rather complicated, it has the right property. Okay, let me summarize. We have developed a general method to compute the semi-classical correlation functions at strong coupling for non-BPS string states with very large quantum numbers when they are describable by the finite gap method of integrable systems. We have illustrated that for the GKP string, but you can apply the same method for other finite gap solutions. And again, once more, I'd like to emphasize that that method does not require the explicit form of the vertex operators, nor the explicit form of the eigen function, the saddle point solution. And we applied that to the GKP string, and we obtained a completely finite, very reasonable answer. So there should be many, many applications of this kind of result applying to other types of string, especially it should be very important to study the case of the strings in ADS2, Cortex 3. This is a homework from Yannick and Brzezinski. And this is important because for this case, the computation of the Supriyar-Mill side is in the SU2 sector and should be easier than the GKP case. And we are currently working on that. And more ambitiously, it would be very nice if we can apply this method to the four-point functions and study how the crossing solution will come out. So we hope to report progress on this and related matters in the near future, and thank you very much for your kind attention.
Okay, so I have two small questions. So one, can you elaborate a bit more on the first point? Do you have something to say about this first point there? How do the results look like? Do you have?
We don't yet have the results, so I can't say that now.
Uh-huh. But are there new ingredients? What's the basic new ideas when you go to the sphere?
New ingredient is that the, for instance, you know that the Kostov has computed the three-point function on the Supriyar-Mill side with a rather general case. So we would like to do that too, in the general case. That would mean that you have to deal with a rather general genus zero. Genus zero is the simplest genus zero solution, which contains parameters. So the structure of the P hat is rather complicated. So that's much more complicated than this GKP case. Of course, if you stick to some very simple example, maybe we can do it much more easily. But if you want a general solution, mm-hmm. it is technically rather complicated. So okay. We are still working.
And the other question is about, can you take the limit where the three operators are large, but one is much smaller than the other two, and compare with the results of Kostia and Miguel Kostia?
We try to think about that too, but I think that it's not really justified. Right? By taking it to completely zero, that has a meaning. That's why we checked it out, you know, in that case. But if one of them is small, then of course you cannot apply directly the saddle point method
Why not? If it's big but much smaller than the other two, why not? If it's of order of square root of lambda but
yeah,
much
but
smaller than the other
take
two.
Take into account that the contribution from that small guy, reliably, without quantum consideration.
I don't think if it exponentiates, because Costio's result also exponentiates when the small operator is small compared to the other two,
yeah,
but
maybe,
big.
Maybe at the end it may, you may be able to justify it, but logically, it's not very easy to justify. For me, at least.
Another question. So by dealing with classical solution, you're rather dealing with some coherent states rather than with exact eigenstates of dilatation operators. Do you know how to extract actual three-point function of three eigenstates of dilatation operators out of data which you manage to obtain?
I don't quite understand your question.
So classical solutions, these are not exact states. These are like coherent states, right?
Well,
these are wave packets.
You mean on this Kriyamil side? This is a string, a classical string.
Right, but eventually what you want to get is a strong coupling limit of a three-point function.
Yeah, this is a strong coupling limit.
Right, so my question is how to relate this three-point function to a computation of minimal surfaces? Because presumably by computing minimal surfaces with some boundary condition, you're computing not three-point function of three eigenstates, but of some coherent states, which is not exactly the same in this case.
As I explained, first part was precisely the computation of the area. Okay, except that we have to take it out the small singularities. But of course, in order to compute the correlation functions, the contributions of the vertex operator are extremely important. And that's how we strive to evaluate these things without actually constructing the vertex operators. Operators are very difficult to construct.
Right, but still you assume that close to the boundary the solution looks more or less the same as for two-point function.
Yeah. That's
right, but my question is whether this assumption is correct and how
well,
can you justify it?
If you say that is not correct...
Let me play a role of Sergei.
I don't know what to say, because that's a kind of a definition.
Did you look at the limit, very natural limit, when all three spins are very big, much bigger than square root of lambda? We tried your result for this limit, and it seems to be too simple, at least simpler than our expectations. It's just some power of kappa 1 plus kappa 2 plus kappa 3. And at least if you compute it in tree-like approximation, and of course it's not the same limit, but you try to compare the structure, it seems to be oversimplified. Did you try this limit? Just
no,
all
no,
kappas go to infinity.
No,
I mean,
not.
It's a very simple thing to do.
I see. That's very interesting. Yeah. Okay.
I have a very simple question. You somehow, when you have shown the final expression for the correlation function, you assumed it's a scalar correlation function. But
no, it's not a scalar.
Could you show the result?
It depends on the spin, so therefore it's not...
Yeah, but where is dependence?
It's very simple. It's,
X dependence is just like of scalar.
That's right, because it's a SL2 cross SL2.
Yes.
Okay? So SL2, one of the SL2s act on X, and the other one acts on X bar.
But if you compare this to three-point function of twist two operators on gauge side, there will be prefactor depending on X, difference of spins, difference of coordinates, and spins as well as the...
Well, the effect of spins is encoded already in here.
No, that's a canonical... These are canonical dimensions. Well, maybe
it's not canonical dimensions. It has a spin dependence in here.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
Okay, let's thank Hirsch again.